Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Thank you.
Deep Purple, Demon's Eye from their fifth studio album, Fireball, released on the 9th of July 1971 and Harvest on Warner Brothers label.
Deep Purple. Do you know, I really, 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 really like that song. It's really odd, you know, when you just sit yourself down and actually, because we listen to the show, all the music as we play it.
That's right.
I love that song. The bass line, when it starts to doom-ga-doom, boom, yeah. Boom, boom.
Bass.
The space in it. It's just, and it's got, I love the way that the bass and the guitar do the same, like, licks at the same time as well. It's just
and the organ, of course.
It's just beautiful. I really, really like it.
Well, it's surprising because, you know, you used to be a folk sort of.
I know. This is why I'm a little bit surprised at me telling you that I like it.
Well, we haven't played a lot of Deep Purple on this show because one of the main reasons is I don't particularly like their studio albums, really.
Yeah.
But the other day, our good pal at a gig, Dave Swindells, between our sets, put this on. He put it on his little iPod player thing off his phone, and I thought, what a great song, and I'd forgotten about it, and I dug the album out again, Fireball, fantastic record, and it's these earlier studio albums were actually great, I thought. The later ones, the ones with the big hits on, like, you know, Deep Purple in Rock, and those albums, the later ones, I just didn't like, because Made in Japan, for me, is the best live album ever produced, and that's all I can listen to Deep Purple, really. I listen to that album, I think, well, that's it, that is Deep Purple at their finest. But listening to this, it's tremendous. And Richie Blackmore is one of my favourite guitar players. He's in my top 10, definitely, because you can instantly tell it's him. The first note he plays on his solos, he's got that gritty sound, but beautiful smoothness in his playing, and very unusual little licks he does, and little trills, and his syncopation's really great. And I think at that point, I'm sorry just to carry on here, but he was also using, I think, the original Rangemaster with his Marshall amps, which is like it's another fuzz, but a very specialised fuzz. It was called a British secret weapon. The Americans, because they didn't know what it was. All these guys were using Rangemasters, and nobody in America knew what it was. And this is it's sort of round about the same time, a fuzz, but it's a completely different circuit, a different thing. Of course, we've got two of the buggers here.
Fuzz.
Well, yeah, we've got two specially built for us, the Supertone models, by Dan Whitelock Jones from DWJ in Liverpool. Great guy, and he's built these things, and they sound fantastic. But you've got to have the right head on you because they're a bit fierce.
I like that, though. I like a bit of attitude. You know that, don't you? Yeah. It's just like, come on, let's have it. Now, Richie Blackmore, I don't really know much about him. In fact, I didn't really know much about Deep Purple. You know, it's another band that I know, and they all tend to merge like paint all splattered on a canvas. And I think one person's in one band and they're not. And it was quite interesting because when I looked at the summary of who Deep Purple are, they kind of survived a seemingly endless series of lineup changes, and they had like a dramatic mid-career shift, didn't they? So they went from like that prog rock thing to the heavy metal thing. And they're credited in the Guinness Book of Records as the world's loudest band at one point, I think. Which I think was interesting. But then when you look at these characters, and I'm really intrigued by the combination of, like, you know, people on their own, when they get together, like the chemistry between them that makes a band stratospheric in a sense. Now, do you know who Richie Blackmore's childhood hero was?
Big Jim Sullivan.
No.
Oh, right. I got that wrong.
You banana head. You ruined that. I was going to.
No, who is it?
Tommy Steele.
No, is that right?
He wanted to be Tommy Steele because he wanted to jump around the stage. And he got a guitar at age 11, right? And his dad insisted he play it properly. So he took a year of classical guitar lessons. And guess who gave him guitar lessons on electric guitar?
That was Big Jim.
Yeah!
And I know this because when I was talking to Big Jim, I mean, he sadly died some years ago now. And he was a big mentor of mine, you know. I spent a few months with him recording the record, the Little Brother record. He was producing with Derek Lawrence.
Yeah.
And Derek Lawrence, of course, produced Hush, the original Deep Purple stuff, and also he produced Wishbone Ash. tied together by the engineer on this this track and a lot of the Deep Purple stuff, Martin Birch, who was the he worked a lot with Derek. He worked a lot with Deep Purple. This was recorded partially at Olympic Studios, was it not, as well?
Yeah, yeah.
Our,
and Elaine Lee Studios.
Yeah, I don't know those. I'm going to have to look them up now. I'm going to have to get my book out in a minute.
I know, it's good, eh?
But it's the thing is with Deep Purple, I always think they were the ultimate in professionalism because I've never really seen a bad live performance of them. They're just great. They were like machines. Ian Paice is probably... I mean, everybody talks about, you know, John Bonham. But I think in terms of rock drums, Ian Paice, in his own way, is just as good as Bonham. I think he's got a swing. I mean, that track swings for a rock band.
Yeah.
It's sort of... It's like a shuffly sort of thing. It really swings, that song. And then, you know, John Lord, of course, the keyboard player, he... or Hammond player, he invented sticking a Hammond through Marshall amps because he couldn't get Leslie's loud enough. So he just used to plug them direct into, and it was monstrous. Now I went to see him on the Deep Purple on the Men in Japan tour right about that time, and I've never heard anything like it. In fact, I couldn't hear anything for 2 weeks, literally. But it was fantastic. I just love that band.
What's the fingers close?
Echo and the Bunnymen. That's the cutter from their third studio album, Porcupine, released on the 4th of February 1983.
What a song. What a song. You know, in the depths of our vinyl collection, because the more shows we do, the more difficult it is to find stuff. But it's not, because we keep coming up with great stuff. And that middle eight, when it goes that double kick drum, it is beautiful. It sends shivers down my spine. Of course, Ian McCulloch, the vocalist, also thinks it sends shivers down his spine because he said he was the greatest rock vocalist of all time at one stage.
I do believe he did say that, didn't he?
He did, yeah. But what a song. What a performance. And again, a bit of a link to Liverpool here, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. They were formed in Liverpool in 1978 and they grew out of a band called The Crucial Three, which is a late 70s trio, and it featured Ian McCulloch on vocals, Pete Wiley and Julian Cope. Now, Cope and Wiley, they left at the end of 1977, so Cope went on to form Teardrop Explodes.
Yeah, great band.
And Wiley went on to form a band called Wah. And yeah. Then McCulloch met a guitarist called Will Sargent in the summer of 1978, and they started recording demos together with the drum machine that they called Echo.
No. Ah, no, this is a surprise here. I didn't know about that.
See, I'm giggling because this is so, like, cool, right? And then they met bassist Les Pattinson. He joined the band. And they made their debut at a Liverpool club called Eric's.
Yeah.
Which I think is fantastic.
Oh, Eric's was a legend.
I know.
I've been in there. I remember it was so hot in those days, those punk days. The sweat and the condensation, that the heat of everybody's body and it was dripping off the roof. It was like it was raining in there. Oh, incredible place, Eric's, yeah, back in the day.
Hang on a minute. You went to Eric's?
Of course I did, yeah.
What were you doing in Liverpool?
Well, I did used to go occasionally.
I'm joking.
Because Tim Wright, our the singer who was in Whitefire and all those things, a really good friend of mine, we've been bands together for years, and he was really into punk. I wasn't too into punk, but I went to Eric's, yeah, with him. On
wow, get you. So you surprised me back there.
Oh, there you are, you see. Oh. I'm not just that Manchester lad. I didn't open my mouth for fear of being beaten up again from a Manc, but...
Wow.
Yeah.
So yeah, so there was that scene there. So that's really where... So basically, they sacked the drum machine off and they got Pete DeFreitas to come in and play drums. So that's a kind of background anyway. But didn't know that. Echo.
Yeah. Well, I didn't either. Yeah. And this recorded partially at Trident Studios, with Trident Consoles, of course, which we're very familiar with. Rockfield Studios, which we went to visit a couple of years ago,
was
it?
That's right, inside Wales, like
yeah, yeah.
Monmouth.
That's where Bohemian Rhapsody was recorded, great console, MCI consoles. And at Parr Street, which is Amazon Studios, a.k.a. Parr Street in Liverpool,
yeah.
Which we also got a connection with because we were in there 12 months ago, weren't we?
We were, so, indeed.
Yeah. So.
I really love studios and I love the history of Parr Street. In fact, every studio we go into, near enough, there's just great stories. And,
yeah.
And, I mean, sometimes sometimes the spaces aren't that enjoyable, but Parr Street was kooky, wasn't it? It was kind of really cool.
Yeah, and when you saw the piano, the upright,
oh,
that,
yeah.
Chris Martin wrote Yellow on from Coldplay, and that was an amazing...
Studio too.
Yeah, that's like... right, yeah. And but anyway, that was produced by Ian Brodie.
Yes.
Now, Ian Brodie, of course, Lightning Seeds... He was in, was it Made in Japan? Big in Japan, sorry, not Made in Japan. That's Deep Purple. Yeah, but, and he, of course, went on to great things, you know.
Yeah.
But it's nice to see him, and I didn't know he produced his record, but he did a great job of it.
Well, he shared a flat with Will Sargent.
No.
Yeah. Ah. See, and talking about scene, talk about people actually, yeah. And this is what, even though I keep saying it's all about the music for me, but... Now that I've got someone to talk to like you and we talk about stories, it's lovely to see how the jigsaw puzzle puts together and why people got together and how they got together to make this beautiful music that I love, that we love.
Mm.
It's interesting because there's real people behind it with lovely stories.
Wasn't the one that you gave to me that night down south between the trailer. Not the early one that you wish upon. Not the northern one, the guards and the sailors. You've got that touch so gentle and sweet, but you've got that look so critical. Can't talk to you, babe, you know I get so weak. Sometimes I think that love is just mythical. Up there's a heaven, down there's a town. Blackness everywhere, a little light shine. Blackness, blackness, dragging me down. Come on out again, oh, in this heart of mine.
No, it's not Joni Mitchell, it's Nazareth, This Flight Tonight, released as a 7-inch single on October 1973 on the Mooncrest label and on their first studio album, Loud and Proud, which was released a month after.
So we've got Scottish hard rock rockers singing lyrics like Starlight, Star Bright.
Yeah.
It never ceases to amaze me.
Well, it's a great...
Ooh.
Great version of it. But when it's you great. Listen to the original, of course, on Blue, Joni Mitchell, it's actually not that much different. It's done on an acoustic guitar.
Oh,
but
yeah.
That pull up with the acoustic guitar is really, really, really good. And, of course, that was produced by Roger Glover. Now, we don't do this on purpose, but, of course, Roger Glover, the bass player out of Deep Purple.
No, we didn't do that on purpose.
No. And, you know, and these connections through the show, it's only when we start researching it, we start talking about it live right now, that we realise the connection.
It's odd as well, you know, because that single went to number one in Germany. It was number two in Austria, 5 in Switzerland, 11 in the UK. It connects, isn't it? I mean, that's a completely different version.
Yeah.
Because what was happening as well, so they're from Dunfermline, these guys in Nazareth, and they love Blue, the album by Joni Mitchell. And people say, you remember that gap-toothed vocalist, Dan McCafferty? He had hair like a kitchen scourer and a voice to match.
Yeah.
I love that description.
Great voice, though.
He said, they were bad, bad boys. And among the tracks on this album, Loud and Proud, right, so they had this kind of talk version, of course, of This Flight we've just played for you. Now, they said, we used to listen to Joni as we were travelling round in the van. And that's what Agnew, the bass player, was saying. And it was like, This Flight Tonight was one of their favourites. So So they ended up being in America on an American tour, obviously, because they're in America, at the very same time that Joni Mitchell was going back into the studio at A&M, and they ended up meeting her in the studio.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So they told her what they'd done, and she said, "What, with a rock band?" Can you imagine? It's like, "Oh, well, we're from Nazareth, right? We're hard rockers. We've just done a cover of your song."
Fantastic.
So anyway, she gave him the biggest compliment, because when she did a gig later on in London, she said, "I'd like to open with a song by Nazareth."
Well, that's quite beautiful, you know. But of course, it probably made her a whole load of money as well, which wouldn't have gone down. But that was also engineered by, it was recorded at the Pi Mobile at their rehearsal studio. What was that called?
The Gang Hut.
The Gang Hut, that's right, up in
Jamestown.
Yeah, on the Pi Mobile Neve console. But Jeff Emmerich was one of the engineers on the session. And if you listen to that middle bit, that sort of middle bit, that middle eight thing, which it changed the feel completely, you listen and go back now, rewind it and listen to the bass sound on it, because that could be the Beatles. If you listen to what he's done, it just comes in that middle at a completely different time before it goes back into the chugging guitar again. Absolutely fantastic.
I'm just looking at you now, thinking, grinning, going, "You're right."
Rintra roars and shakes his fires in the burdened air. Hungry clouds swag on the deep. Without contraries, there is no progression, attraction and repulsion, reason and energy, love and hate are necessary to human existence. From these contraries spring what the religious call good and evil. Good is the passive that obeys reason. Evil is the active, springing from energy. Good is heaven, evil is hell. As I was walking among the fires of hell, delighted with the enjoyments of genius, to which angels look like torment and insanity, I collected some of their proverbs. The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. The roaring of lions, the howling of wolves, the raging of the stormy sea, and the destructiveness of the sword are portions of eternity too great for the eye of man. Everything is possible. To be believed is an image of truth. The tigers of wrath are wiser than the horses of instruction. Never know what is enough unless you know what is more than enough. exuberance is beauty. Sooner murder an infant in its cradle than nurse enacted desires. Thus, men forgot all deities reside in the human breast. For the cherub with his flaming sword is hereby commanded to leave his guard at the tree of life. And when he does, the whole creation will be consumed and appear infinite and holy, whereas it now appears finite and corrupt. This will come to pass by an improvement in sensual enjoyment. But first, the notion that man has a body distinct from his soul is to be expunged. This I shall do by printing in the infernal method of corrosives, which in hell are salutary and medicinal. Melting apparent surfaces away and deploying the infinite which was hid. For man has closed himself up till he sees all things through narrow chinks of his cavern. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite.
Phrygian Gates. That's a piece written by John Adams, and that's from the album Heaven and Hell, The Doors of Perception by Harriet Stubbs, and it was released last month. And she ran a pledge campaign to fund the album. And you can hear the voice of the wonderful Marianne Faithfull.
I wondered who it was. Now, this is a new one, you see. I don't know anything about this record at all. You've just sprung this on me.
Intrigued me.
Yeah, it's a cool thing.
It's kind of almost... I've been trying to work out what words to put to this, you know. How do we even talk about this? Because it's like you've got Marianne Faithfull, a rock icon. You've got John Adams, and I didn't know anything about this chap, and he's like this, he's got these roots in minimalist music. Well, what the hell's minimalist music anyway? So I was thinking, I've got this guy, and then there's a lady called Harriet Stubbs, who's a child prodigy, a pianist who's been playing from the age of 3 and won a scholarship to the Guildhall School of Music age 5, and she's one of that sort of caliber of musician. And
lovely playing.
Beautiful. But what's brought all this together was the producer, Ross Titelman, and he produced, he's won 3 Grammys, and he produced the Stevie Winwood song Higher Love, and he was also the producer for Eric Clapton's Journeyman and Unplugged albums. He got Grammys for those.
Yeah, I mean, he's done a lot of other things. Yeah. He did the George Harrison album, of course, in 1979 as well.
Okay.
So it's like, and James Taylor, Ry Cooder, he's done a lot of really cool stuff, but it's that slightly, you know, softer side.
So I understand. So you've got this guy, this kind of calibre of this guy, okay, so he's bringing all this project together. Now, I've worked out a little bit of a system just to try and clarify what the hell's going on here, really. So the album's called The Door of Perception, and that was like a concept thing.
that started off with William Blake and later Aldous Huxley, and then the Doors had this whole thing about the doors of perception. And it's essentially about the journey from innocence to experience. And then you go into a state, apparently, of higher innocence, and you access that state of higher innocence through the doors of perception.
Wow.
So it's really trippy, isn't it? So I've kind of worked out what this thing is minimalist. So you've got this guy called John Adams, okay? Now, he was born in America, in Worcester, but not Worcester in the UK.
No.
In Massachusetts, darling.
In Worcester.
Worcester. Like Worcester sauce, but not from, yeah, anyway, 1947. So John Adams is a composer, conductor, and he's kind of he's a creative thinker, really. And when he was a student, he read a book by a guy called John Cage called Silence, and that was in 1973. And apparently it just blew his psyche and everything changed for him and the world opened up. So this book, Silence by John Cage, and I think this minimalist thing, he really started to explore that music is about sounds, it's about rivers, it's about streams. You can get music in everyday life, and you don't have to have the you don't have to go and learn a classical instrument. You can hear it in whiskey glasses or in ancient cymbals, you know, you can, or bicycle wheels.
Well, that piano, it did sound, I mean, there's some brilliant syncopations. I would love to see the sheet music of that, because I bet it looked like fly poo on the paper, because it's like, you know, it's one of those things that you look at and you think, oh my goodness, you know. But yeah, it's great. And Marianne Faithfull as well. I mean, what a great voice she's got. And, you know, people talk about getting older and, you know, oh, I don't look as good. I don't, yeah. But that voice, my God, it sounds great, you know.
The thing is as well, she's lived. She's still living. I mean, as in she's there, you know, she's gone through so many different adventures. And I was just reading, and I remember in a previous show I told you I saw her at the Bridgewater Hall.
That's right.
So I was just reading now that she's somewhere over in Europe, and she's, I think, performing in a Brecht show. And it's not lots of, she doesn't earn a lot of money. And, but I think what happened was that things kind of changed once they had that drugs bust when she was dating Mick Jagger years and years ago. But she's got, I think the reason why they asked Marianne to do the narration on this piece was because it's kind of classical music and rock meeting, and she's kind of that merging. She can melt the ideas.
Well, she did a great job on it, isn't it, about that? And the actual lyric itself, the actual words are quite, you know, I'm going to have to listen to it again now.
Did you notice they're a bit fuzzy at the beginning?
Mm.
And then they get more clear, and they became more and more to the front in the production of it. Because right. I couldn't understand what she was saying at first. It wasn't that clear. And then, but I'm not really, the first hearing or second hearing for me is more, I just hear the odd words like exuberance or, I can't even remember now, because the words actually don't mean anything. It's to start with, it's more a texture, isn't it? It's like a feel with it all. Anyway, we just thought, I just wanted to bring something new to the table and something different, because it is music and it's a bit trancey as well.
Beautiful, absolutely beautiful. I'm going to be putting that on again later on.
Won't have to wait to see. I'm gonna meet
Doyle Bramhall II, Everything You Need, from the fifth studio album, Shades, released on the 5th of October 2018, which has been released on the Provogue label, part of the Mascot label group, featuring Eric Clapton.
His mate, Eric.
Mm.
He's done a lot of work, actually, Doyle, hasn't he, with Eric? Because he played on Riding with the King when Eric was working with B.B. King.
John Hyatt record. Yeah, John Hyatt.
And he's toured with him, and he was... He was his opening act and also part of his band when Eric's 50th anniversary tour. So that's Doyle Bramhall II.
Yeah, well, I mean, he really came to our attention.
Because?
When that single came out, it was a year ago, two years ago.
No, I know, and I just looked it up again. Mama Can't Help You.
Yeah, with James Gadson.
We have to go, James Gadson, we love you.
Yeah, because, it was, even though it was... It was like Bill Withers with sunglasses on, because of course Gadson was playing drums on it. It's a great record, but the video, it's one thing you've got to watch. But anyway, back to this is his new record.
I just want to add as well that subsequently as well, when we were saying about getting a Gadson fix, James Gadson actually was talking to me on our Facebook, our Starlight Campbellman Facebook page.
Indeed he was.
And it was so exciting because it was like, yo, hello. Yeah. Anyway, because see, the thing is, we're all human beings and I really like that because...
One of our favourite drummers, isn't he?
Oh, I know. You know, I'd love to groove on a song with him because he's just such a beautiful player and he's just got a groove. It's fantastic.
Well, him and Kalyuta. I mean, there's some great drummers out there. But I love Gadson.
Anyway, I know we digress, but I think we had to because we need another track with Gadson on soon anyway on the
we
show.
Do.
But anyway, so this is a new studio album from Doyle Bramhall II called Shades. And it also features the album he's got. He's collaborated with Norah Jones and the Tedeschi Trucks band. Because he knows, you know, he played with him,
that's right.
Yeah. And I was wondering, you know, sometimes you go, well, who is this guy? Where's he come from? And then you realise that he's got this great ancestry because his dad was a drummer and songwriter and he was in a band called The Chessmen and he went to school with Jimmy Vaughan.
No.
And yeah, and they were in this bank, obviously the Chessmen, and they opened for Hendrix when he played Dallas.
Wow.
So they've got this history there. And then his dad went on to form a band called the Nightcrawlers with Stevie Ray Vaughan. Mm. And he co-wrote the song Dirty Pool, which is on Stevie's debut album, Texas Flood.
Right.
So you've got this ancestry of Doyle's father being totally in the heart of that scene.
Jimmy Vaughan, of course, that's Fabulous Thunderbirds.
Exactly. Yeah. And of course, well, when Doyle was 18, he played with the Fabulous Thunderbirds for 2 years.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah, neither did I.
Wow.
Until I looked into it, because I was thinking, you know, and he admits he's had a charmed life, because what I've realised as well is that there's a lot of people that have talent, and sometimes you just don't meet the right people to connect you in with the right people to help you develop as an artist. And I think that sometimes you've really, I don't know whether it's luck or whether or not it's, I don't know what it is, but sometimes people, you just got to get in with the right family, haven't you?
Well, you know, people say you got to be in the right place at the right time, but you've got to be out there. You've got to be out there to be in the right place. You know, to be in a scene, you've actually got to go out and find and seek out that scene and find out where you are. You know, you have these connections, but you've got to, you know, you've got to get into those connections and work with people and not be frightened of just going and picking up a guitar and playing with these guys, you know?
Yeah.
That is what really, and it does kind of upset me, because, you know, when I was, you know, playing guitar at the beginning, and certainly in my formative, when I was starting really think about solo records and stuff, I used to be jamming all the time with everybody. You know, I did a lot of sessions, and I was jamming with just different people and different, and sometimes they weren't great musicians, but you always learned something, you always got something out of it, you know, and that's one thing that I do miss. I don't think that people are doing that anymore, and it's very, very sad. And because of that, people's musicianship is not as good as it was. It's not as immediate, and people just don't want to get up and jam because they're terrified of being put on YouTube. I mean, a very famous, but I won't tell you who he is, but he's a very famous bass player. He teaches bass, but he will no longer perform live because he's frightened of making a mistake. So his students see him make a mistake. Now, that's wrong. Wrong, 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 wrong. You know, Jimmy Page never worried about that. Even, you know, all the great guitar players. I mean, I've heard Jeff Beck made some absolutely monstrous cock-ups. You know, he pulls them out because he gets all of his tremolo and just whoop, and pulls it back up again, you know. So, and you know, all these people, but to go for it, you listen to Jan Ackerman, you know, and yeah, he's brilliant, but he'll stick a stinky note in there occasionally, but you don't notice it because the overall brilliance, you know, and
I totally agree with you. No, and I get that. And before, and I went through that phase when I first started playing bass, because I was scared. I was very scared, actually, and I remember this. We were only talking about this earlier today, the difference in my playing, having been out and playing a couple of times a week now, and just really...
For 2 years.
Yeah.
I'm rehearsing at home and practicing stuff and writing and recording. I mean, you've
everything.
Had it, you know.
But I tell you what I've realised now is that I'm actually in the music so much now that I'm just going for. I'm in the music, and you know what? I don't care if I make a mistake, because I'm approaching it with an open heart.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. Going for it, whether or not it's a subtle piece or it's a full on. I'm there.
That's right.
It's not about being perfect, because perfect music is boring, or perfect music to me doesn't say anything.
Agreed. You know, recording without distortion, all those things. It's like, you know. Anyway, just a little aside there, of course. Doyle Bramhall, known for his fuzz, a bit of fuzz guitar.
No,
yeah, I
had
to mention
fuzz.
I've mentioned Rage Master, but a bit of fuzz there. But that's it. That is the end of the show for this week.
Right.
Well, so what do we do now?
Well, I was going to say, you can get in contact with us.
Yeah.
We've got a Twitter account, which is at Susie and Simon, on Facebook and Instagram.
And the show's available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio. And now we seem to have it all over the place. We've got it on FM stations and internet stations.
I know,
everywhere.
It's growing. So. It's fantastic, though. Because it's about hanging out, isn't it? Playing music and having a good old chat, really, about stuff. The way it should be, really.
It sure is.
But we're going to play you out with a fantastic track by a Deutsch band. We're having nine band, and El Name is Neu.
Now, Neu, you know, when you talk about krautrock and you talk about music from Dusseldorf in 1971, and you listen to stuff that is produced now, you know, or pretty recently, Kasabian, The Horrors. There's, you know, I can think of dozens of bands that have actually nicked this groove. And, you know, I love the beginning because obviously they've done something with the tape speed, because it starts with a bit in wonky and it sort of, whoop, it just moves up like a half semitone or something. And it sort of, but these guys really created, along with Can and that whole krautrock thing, something that is, it keeps reoccurring. It's like rock and roll music, like Chuck Berry. People have reinvented Chuck Berry so many times. People have reinvented, you know, tried to reinvent the Beatles. People try, but this is one of these, you know, bands that people just keep copying and doing it again, but just slightly different.
It's weird, isn't it? Because you've got Klaus Dinger.
It's a great name.
It's a great name. Michael Rother? Yeah. Rother, yeah. Mm. So they formed Neu after they split from Kraftwerk, the first innings, as it were. But what was so they, so this, we're going to play you a track called Für Immer, which is forever. It's from the second studio album released in 1973 by Brain Records, which was a Hamburg-based record label. And it was produced by Connie Plank from Can, yeah, of course, and recorded at Windrose Dumont Time Studios in Hamburg. Now, their first album sold 30,000 records. That's not bad for an underground band, really. And today, this album and the other one is considered a masterpiece. So David Bowie was into them, Brian Eno, Iggy Pop, Tom York of Radiohead. They absolutely loved Neu. But the thing about this album, before we play the track, is that they ran out of money halfway through.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and do you know what they had to do? And that's what inspired the B-side, is they just decided to remix two singles they'd already got. So they just messed around with it, and it began. So it was a remix thing, because the whole of the album was like, they were at loggerheads with each other, and they were, and then halfway through they had no money.
Wow. Well, there we are. Enjoy it.
And the one thing I remember a friend of mine saying to me, he said, you know what? You're at your most creative when you're at your poorest.